You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello again, and welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. I have some good news for people who care. My book on the Russo-Ukrainian War of 2022 is finished. It needs one more run-through of the material, content-wise, and then it will be published. So that timetable is a separate matter. But It is completed. I think the iron is hot here. I think the war is more or less over. But I have to commit at some point, so it needs to be done. I'm happy to say that. Less joyous, however, is 2025 is the 50th anniversary of the fall of Saigon. The Vietnam War being not just a crucible for the Vietnamese nation, but something that the ruling classes used to divide the U.S. intensely. The Cultural Revolution, to a great extent, may not have been able to happen without the Vietnam War, or more specifically, the draft. But I have to make a few introductory distinctions. I was a supporter and would still be, if it were, you know, the Cold War was still on, a supporter of American interventionism, but not after the fall of the USSR. Since the end of the Cold War, so let's say 1991, American military intervention abroad has taken on a completely different meaning. Now, the U.S. was never anti-Marxist, but it did worry about a very large empire that may impinge on its interests, regardless of that empire's ideology. The USSR was revolutionary, of course, and that revolution was meant to be exported. It was, by definition, by its very ideological structure, dedicated to taking over the world. That was its stated purpose. Revolution was meant to be global. Of course, millions would die in the process. Stopping that is, by itself, legitimate grounds for intelligent and rational American intervention. Now, communist governments, regardless of any distinction, whether their culture, level of technical advancement, region, race, they all become killing machines. They have a huge network of re-education camps. They're always a one-party state. They all drive their populations to poverty. Now, quite often, communist parties were made up of foreigners, in most cases, using Marxism as a smokescreen for their own mercenary interest. The last thing any of them care about is labor. But they all have taken on this same set of properties, fully consistent with the dictatorship of the proletariat. That was a conception that's a practical core of Marxism. Both the USSR and Maoist China are proof of this. You know, one of my biggest pet peeves is that even today, their mass murders are fully acceptable in American academia and in journalism. To support these leaders, to even claim to be a Maoist or something like that, that's cause for advancement in academia. The only thing that isn't is fascism, however that might be defined. Now, once the Gulag states either reformed or disappeared in the early 1990s, the purpose of American intervention changed. That's why interventions now don't have a lot in common with interventions decades ago. Since 1990, U.S. military adventurism abroad has been against generally rightist governments that have not threatened the U.S., and they are not at all connected into a revolutionary network. In the Mideast, intervention serves Israel only. It existed during the Cold War, too. The two concerns dovetailed perfectly, with the Soviets supporting Iraq and Syria. Eurasianist Russia and National Socialist China are not totalitarian systems that threaten the world. Quite the contrary. In fact, they are better administered and generally more prosperous than the U.S., and certainly more stable. The regime, the global ruling class centered at BlackRock and Davos, is a leftist entity in a very broad sense. It is, by itself, revolutionary. The fourth industrial revolution that they promote is revolutionary. There's only one ideology that threatens it. And they said this at Bilderberg, too, and that's nationalism of whatever type. The endless interference in other nations' elections and conflicts only benefits the ruling class. It can't be justified on rational grounds. There is no massive empire dedicated to world revolution using totalitarian methods and slaughtering millions. The bad guy now is the U.S. Because of this, you don't see an anti-war movement in America today. For nationalists, American intervention doesn't have any legitimacy. However, it did, in theory, during the Cold War. Using the example of Vietnam is very important, but it certainly can't be taken in isolation. One of the interesting things about it is that the ruling classes actually were at war with the state. The ruling class are far more, they're made up of state actors, but many more, you know, academic and scientific and media, financial, which is a very rare circumstance. The regime, such as it was back then, was opposed to the Vietnam War, while the government, especially the presidency in Washington, wanted the Soviets to know that there was a line that can't be crossed. And at the height of the Vietnam War, the Jews had disengaged from the USSR. Because it simply wasn't profitable anymore. Many of them went to the US, many to Israel. Now, I think it's very suspicious that there's no anti-war movement in the US today. The wars that we've been dealing with since 1990 have gone on far longer than Vietnam and have no purpose or rational justification. Now, the difference might be the lack of a draft, but still, that doesn't explain why there's no movement against moving nuclear warheads against Russia. If this were 1980, there would have been riots, and in fact, there were. It suggests to me that the anti-war movement of the 70s was backed by the ruling class. Now, I've dealt with this elsewhere, so I won't get into that today. I was just a little kid when the Vietnam War ended. Although, that's actually incorrect. The Vietnam War, you know, just morphed into other wars, especially concerning Cambodia, the Vietnamese invasion, etc. There are people who reject the idea of even entering the Vietnam War. One of their justifications is that Ho Chi Minh was driven to the hands of Moscow following World War II because the U.S. refused his appeals to help keep the French from returning to Indochina. That's simply not true. The U.S. was vehemently anti-colonialist at the time. Ho Chi Minh, very few people know this, who signed an agreement with the French, actually a modus vivendi in March 6, 1946, point two of which declared his government's willingness, and I'm quoting here, to welcome amicably the French army when it returned to Vietnam. And the following day, Ho Chi Minh, the French commanding general, Jean Leclerc, issued a joint communique calling on the people of Vietnam to welcome the French back. The betrayal of nationalism there led to actual nationalists taking to the hills to prepare for a guerrilla war against the returning French. Now, Ho and the Communist Party, or to create it in France, their purpose was deeper than this. They wanted to use the French to destroy any of the reactionaries, many of the militias throughout Vietnam, some of which were very large, that would not like a communist movement dependent on the USSR. And almost guaranteed a Marxist-Leninist leadership. But contrary to the popular mythology that the U.S. supported the return of French colonialism to Indochina after the war, after the war, the great Bernard Fall noted in his classic study, The Two Vietnams, which came out in 1963, the French general Satigny radioed his superiors in Calcutta that he was face-to-face with a deliberate Allied maneuver to evict the French from Indochina. And at the present time, the Allied attitude is more harmful than that of the Viet Minh. It was said that the Pentagon Papers exposed all the lies and the fraud of the war, but that's only really in the abridged versions. I found, now I don't think I've been through every word of the 7,000 pages of this, but I've been through quite a bit of it over the years. And it doesn't say, as always, what the left wants to believe it says. And it provides excellent background here. The U.S. prohibited the French from using American weapons in their campaign to return to power. The American ambassador to Paris in 1948 was instructed to do everything he could to keep the French out. The U.S. backed Vietnamese independence like they did in Indonesia. Ho Chi Minh was one of the co-founders of the French Communist Party in 1920, and then was sent to Vietnam. He was a representative of the Communist International for Southeast Asia. From then on, he was a toast to the American universities. He was present at the founding of the Indo-Chinese Communist Party in February 1930 in Hong Kong, but he didn't come close to Vietnam between 1911 and 1941. He didn't want to cooperate with nationalist groups against the French. No, he betrayed many of Vietnam's most respected leaders and used the French as a means of raising funds and eliminating possible future opposition. And that's a fact that doesn't get brought up very much at all. The claim that he was a nationalist, of course, butchers the term nationalism. That's like something along the lines of Soviet patriotism. Now, within the Third World, you did have certain forms of National Socialism. But that line is very vague. In this case, like the Cuban case, it isn't. So Ho Chi Minh said, genuine patriotism was an aspect, part and parcel, in fact, of internationalism. It could never be separated from proletarian internationalism. Which, in the way that he meant it, didn't make any sense. The premier of Vietnam said, in our country, to be a patriot is to love socialism. Patriotism is closely linked to socialism, and the communist, the internationalist, is the most genuine patriot. So after 1954, the Vietnamese Communist Party ruled the North, initially founded really in 1930, by Nguyen A. Quoc, who eventually took the name of Ho Chi Minh, who was a bureaucrat within the Comintern. The handful of Vietnamese communist exiles in Hong Kong. Initially, it was the Indochinese Communist Party, but by 51, they had changed their name to the Vietnamese Workers' Party, or the Vietnam Workers' Party. They wanted to eliminate communists to give the impression that they, in fact, were not Stalinists at that point. So when you read someone like Noam Chomsky, who is a pseudo-intellectual, if there ever was one, a faker, a absolute, you can't be a multimillionaire and fed it in every upper class conference in the world and claimed to be a dissident. That's not what a dissident is. He doesn't use words like communist or Stalinist. Noam Chomsky supported the Khmer Rouge as well as the Vietnamese Communist Party. Remember, the Vietnamese communist attitude to Stalin wasn't just a matter of political convenience. Long after the death of Stalin in 1953, it was different in North Vietnam. They revered Stalin publicly. Same thing for North Korea. So as the Soviets had distanced themselves from Stalin, in December of 1979, it was the 100 year of Stalin's birth. Here was part of their official commentary in the newspaper. Regarding the international communist and workers' movement and the national liberation movement in the world, Stalin, together with other Soviet leaders, contributed a great deal to the varied activities. In conjunction with other party leaders, Stalin waged the struggle against all expressions of opportunism, Trotskyism, right opportunism, bourgeois nationalism, in defense of the purity of Marxism-Leninism. Now, a few others have pointed out that there was also a strong Maoist influence. Don't overstate the distinction between Maoism and Stalinism on the development of the Vietnamese Communist Party. Ho went to both countries, in fact. After the Chinese victory against the Nationalists, Ho also went to Peking. Stalin instructed Mao to provide all the military equipment, anything they need. The Chinese also brought their entire apparatus, or actually I should say exported their entire social apparatus, social organization, terrorist campaigns to North Vietnam. Things were far worse in the North than most people realize, and certainly more than anyone realized at the time. One of the worst was the land reform campaign. These communists were butchers. They would use a phrase like land reform, which everyone loves, right? Military dictators all over the world had real land reform, giving land back to the tillers. But that's not what any of this was. It was a terror campaign. Mao used it to massacre several million. Local rural elites in North China, 1947-48, and Southern China, right up to 1953. The same thing in Vietnam. Tens of thousands of peasants, most of them falsely labeled landlords. But in both Vietnam and China, there weren't few landlords in rural areas, so the cadres had to invent them. So they chose to denounce and kill anyone who had maybe a little bit more money than someone else. That's what the land to the tiller program really was. Of course, then later on, any promises they made then became collectivization. Once they broke the back of the peasantry, they were more easily able to create a collectivized agricultural system. The number of deaths may never be known. In China, it's been estimated, we know, anywhere between 20 and 50 million. It's because Vietnam is smaller, it's the number is much smaller, but still absolutely horrendous. I refuse to believe that people like Noam Chomsky didn't know that. It's conceivable that the elites in the state apparatus in the U.S. didn't know that, because they just went by what the media said. Every once in a while I come across an article that's good, not necessarily academic, but one by Robert Turner, Examining the Myths of the Vietnam War in 2004. And this one concerns Ngo Dinh Diem, who was a very good man, who even Ho Chi Minh, respected, he was an enemy, but respected him as really the only man who could hold South Vietnam together. The big issue, kind of been forgotten now, but the big issue was the so-called reunification elections during the 1954 Geneva Conference, and those elections were scheduled then for 1956. The American press deliberately misquoted President Eisenhower to the effect that 80% of the Vietnamese people would have voted for Ho Chi Minh in the unification election. That isn't true. Pentagon Papers, again, supports a lot of this. You read in there that neither the U.S. nor Diem State of Vietnam signed anything at the Geneva Conference. Concerning reunification, of course, no one liked the division of Vietnam. Lost out when the French accepted the proposal of Viet Minh delegate Pham Van Dong. And that's by the same author of Vietnamese Communism's Origins and Development, which came out in 1975. Dong was prime minister of Ho Chi Minh's government. His proposal was that Vietnam be united by elections under the supervision of local commissions, whatever that means. Now, we know what communists think of elections. Now, I have no love for elections. They don't mean anything. But they can be, if properly carried out, a referendum, generally speaking, what people might think, in general. The American plan, the South Vietnamese accepted it. Yes, there might be elections, but they should be under the United Nations. Even that was a problem, though. The Soviets vetoed it. But we know if the Northern proposal went through, it would have been 100% for Ho Chi Minh. And that's when the division of Vietnam, the 17th parallel, and the supervision of the agreement by the International Control Commission came into existence. Diem government had no problem with free elections, but not under the auspices of the North. Since when would Hanoi ever allow free elections? Ho and his friends were elected by a 99% margin all the time. The Pentagon Papers, supposed to be this, you know, leftist justifying a set of articles, it's not. The U.S. would not associate itself with any arrangement that brought elections under anything except international observation. The U.S. wouldn't sign the final declaration relating to Vietnam, the Geneva Conference, and neither did the South. The ICC didn't matter anyway. Now, the Eisenhower quote, I should mention, it's another part of the fraud. It's one of these things where actual context really matters. Eisenhower never said that they'd all vote 80% or whatever it was, 90% for Ho. In Felix Green's book that came out in 1966 called Vietnam, Vietnam, he said, the reason the U.S. refused to allow elections was abundantly clear. No one knew the conditions in Vietnam. There's any doubt the elections were held. Ho Chi Minh would be elected by the overwhelming majority of the people. That's not a good thing. Then he says, he quotes Eisenhower, I've never spoken to or corresponded with a person knowledgeable in Indochinese affairs that did not agree that had elections been held, maybe 80% or more of the population would have voted for the communists. Now here's what he actually said. This is the actual quote in full. I have never spoken to or corresponded with a person knowledgeable in Indochinese affairs who did not agree that had elections been held as of the time of the fighting, possibly 80% of the population would have voted for the communist Ho Chi Minh as their leader rather than Chief of State Bao Dai. Indeed, the lack of leadership and drive on the part of the emperor was a factor in the feeling prevalent among Vietnamese that they had nothing to fight for. That's what he said. It had nothing to do with Diem whatsoever. This had to do with the shortcomings, whether true or false, of the emperor. In fact, in the Pentagon Papers note, it says that Diem himself had a reputation for incorruptible nationalism. He actually wanted land reform. Yes, he was in Bao Dai's government. He eventually resigned from it. The so-called Eisenhower quote was a totally different period in Vietnamese history. People who actually were there say that that Diem really did accomplish miracles. In South Vietnam, North Vietnam was purging everybody, at hundreds of thousands of deaths. South Vietnam was actually engaging in land reform. Now here's what you find in the Pentagon Papers, discussing the so-called Eisenhower quote. It is almost certain that by 1956, the proportion which have voted for Ho in a free election against Diem would have been much smaller than 80%. Diem's success in the South had been far greater than anyone could have foreseen, while the North Vietnamese regime had been suffering from food scarcity, low public morale stemming from inept imitation of Chinese communism. In other words, there's no way Ho would have been elected against them. The point of all this that the left was saying at the time, and still say now, that they didn't want Diem to stand for election. They assumed he would lose. It would be seen as a referendum. No, that was the truth of the matter. Back then, you did have actual statesmen in the U.S. who realized what communists were. Not many of them, but a handful. But when this became, when the lie, the Eisenhower quote, became well known, people who cared about the issue, and it was in the media, it was something that persuaded large numbers of literate Americans that the U.S. government was wrong to back him in South Vietnam. Now, I mentioned even Ho Chi Minh respected him. And I actually have a quote for this. This is from the Political Bureau Resolution, November 1963, cited from the Molyar book, the 2006. Here's what Ho said. Consequence of the November coup will be contrary to the calculations of the U.S. imperialists. Diem was one of the strongest individuals resisting the people and communism. Everything that could be done in an attempt to crush the revolution was carried out by Diem. Diem was one of the most competent lackeys of the U.S. imperialists. Among the anti-communists in South Vietnam or exiled in other countries, no one has sufficient political assets or abilities to cause others to obey. In other words, therefore, the lackey administration cannot be stabilized, and the coup of November 1st will not be the last one. That doesn't show signs of a false quote, and it does have a paper trail behind it. Now, there's something else to discuss. Avril Harriman. It's been my position for a long time that the U.S. could have quite easily won the war in Vietnam, especially given the very large Allied force. At its height, you had about 1.5 million men. You're talking about Australia, New Zealand, Thailand, South Korea, South Vietnam, the U.S., a few other places, Taiwan. You had a huge force there. Avril Harriman is one of the reasons why it didn't work. Now, according to the American ambassador to Saigon, Frederick Nolting, from 61 to 63, there was a deliberate attempt on Harriman's part to destroy support for Diem. Now, the first one was that President Kennedy was very sensitive to the concept that he was supporting a Catholic dictatorship, which, of course, was not true, but he thought it might have been. The second was Harriman's groups, and he was very wealthy, his hatred of Diem and his family, fed by the news media, and then the so-called Buddhist crisis. The responsibility for his murder is on Kennedy and Harriman. Despite the reports the Vietnamese forces were doing very well against the communists, not just in a military sense, but in building a rational economy, Harriman didn't care. In fact, that's the reason he wanted a coup against Diem. And this isn't even saying that other leaders like Thieu were incompetent. They were. Still, Diem was very charismatic. That's what Ho was saying in the quote above. The Buddhist crisis was something completely made up. The claim was that because Diem was Catholic, he he was repressing the Buddhists, who were, of course, the majority religion. Why in heaven's name he would do this when this war was based on hearts and minds is anyone's guess. But the UN did send a team to investigate any possible persecution of Buddhists, and they found nothing. However, by the time the report was published, Diem had been murdered. There's an excellent book I recommend from the Roman Catholic position, actually published by Ignatius Press, Jeffrey Shaw, The Lost Mandate of Heaven, The American Betrayal of Vietnamese President Ngo Dinh Diem. The obsession that Harriman had with getting rid of Diem is extremely significant. And of course, Kennedy did nothing to stop it. But Kennedy ignored the advice of an army of people. William Colby, the ambassador Frederick Nolting, General Maxwell Taylor, Robert McNamara, heads of several foreign governments, the French ambassador Roger Larreta, the Philippine Foreign Secretary Salvador Lopez, the Australian government, the British ambassador to Vietnam, all urged Washington to support Diem. This has to be explained, this relentless contempt for Diem. The Pentagon didn't want him to be removed. There was a congressional fact-finding mission to South Vietnam that, of course, any faults, like any government might have, Diem's government was winning the war and winning hearts and minds. It was building a rational economy. But with all that, the coup was carried out November 1st, 1963. Anyone loyal to Diem were deployed to posts, you know, far from the capital. Then eventually chased down Diem and his brother and murdered him outside St. Francis Church. Very nasty form of assassination, too. And it was hard to fill that vacuum. You know, one of the big things that I want to promote is that the South Vietnamese army was highly competent, from the privates to the generals. However, there were some in the command who were very difficult to work with, and a handful that just simply couldn't do their jobs. We'll talk about that in a minute. This is why Nolting resigned from the State Department. There are people like General Harkins saying that the murder of President Diem destroyed any kind of effective U.S. policy in Southeast Asia. There were others other than Harriman, Senator Mansfield, the media. President Johnson, in his typical way, he said to Eugene McCarthy in 1966, he said, you know, we killed them, meaning Diem and his brother. We all got together and got a bunch of thugs, and we went in and assassinated him. Now we've got no political stability since then. I cleaned it up a little bit, but that's typical Lyndon Johnson. So why was he so violently against Diem? Well, from that same book, Avril Harriman and his brother established the W.A. Harriman Company in 1933, merged with the Brown Brothers. Notable employees were George Herbert Walker and Prescott Bush. He was Skull and Bones. Avril was on the board of the Guaranteed Trust Company. In 1925, a concession agreement was made with Harrington Company and Guaranteed Trust to develop manganese deposits in the USSR. Mining, by making $4 million loan to the USSR. So he's one of these people who built the workers' paradise. In 1941, he was placed in charge of the Lend-Lease program, the USSR. He had all kinds of U.S. technology and products to the Soviet Union. Treasury currency plates were shipped to the USSR so that they could freely print U.S. dollars. Then he was made ambassador to the Soviet Union. Lenin, of course, you know, earlier, gave three oil concessions to three major oil companies, Standard Oil, Component Oil Company of New Jersey, formed by Harriman, and Royal Dutch Shell. Again, it was a capitalist who created the workers' paradise in the USSR. Lenin rewarded those who helped him, those who financed the October Revolution, inviting them to become part of the international bank he was creating. that was made up of the Chase National Bank, Equitable Trust, and Guarantee Trust, as well as Kuen Loeb. So in 61, when Anatoly Golitsyn defected from the USSR, he accused Harriman from being a Soviet spy. His claims were immediately dismissed, but we didn't need him to say that he was pro-Soviet. The orders to murder Diem and to make sure it was going to be a million times harder to fight the communists in Vietnam came directly from Harriman. The capitalists built the Soviet Union. They also built North Vietnam. Now, in a more conventional way, when I was growing up, when I was in college, when I was in high school, the way that the Vietnam War was presented to me was that it was a war of the U.S. with a puppet government under Diem and Thieu and a few others later on one side, and freedom fighters, national independence, Viet Cong, NVA on the other. Sometimes even more ridiculous, it was the U.S. versus the North. Keep in mind that the Republic of South Vietnam invited the Americans in. This was not an imperialist move. When you're invited, they didn't force themselves in, like the U.S. and Syria, for example, today. This make-believe idea that the Viet Cong was a homegrown movement was disproven. You know, there the September program, which I've read of the 1967 program of the NLF, was just a verbatim copy of the 1955 program of Hanoi's Fatherland Front. I have the program for the Fatherland Front and Viet Report, February 1966. The slogans of prosperity zones and rent reduction. These slogans are used in the identical ways, so they have to be copied from one. You know, the Viet Cong has to be copying it from the North. But we didn't have access to that stuff in 1970. Now, hilariously, knowing how gullible the American media was, the NLF published a document claiming that it was seeking a largely liberal and democratic regime for South Vietnam. And that comes from the Vassar College online text, the program of the National Liberation Front of South Vietnam, if you could believe they actually said that. But they knew it wasn't true. But the left, if it's written down, they believe it. Now, in 1983, believe it or not, The Economist of London, one of the mouthpieces of the Rothschild family, published an article, and other articles are ever, their articles are unsigned. They're all unsigned. They published an article based on a French television interview with two senior North Vietnamese army generals, and it was entitled, "We Lied to You." Let me quote it directly here. This is February 26, 1983. "Vietnam has at last come clean. In half a dozen sentences in a French television documentary, the North Vietnamese military commander, General Vo Nguyen Giap, and his colleague, General Vo Bam, have demolished some of the myths which helped to swell the anti-Vietnam War movement from San Francisco to Stockholm. According to General Bam, the decision to unleash an armed revolt against the Saigon government was taken by a North Vietnamese Communist Party plenum in 1959. That was a year before the National Liberation Front was set up in South Vietnam. The aim was to reunite the country. So much for the myth that the Viet Cong was an autonomous southern force which spontaneously decided to rise up against the oppression of the Diem regime. And General Baum should know, as a result of the decision, he was given the job of opening up the infiltration trail to the south." In other words, General Baum created the NLF. But to have such an admission in 1983, "We lied to you," rubbing our noses in it, you know, the damage had been done. I was always led to believe that the Pentagon Papers were something that could be used to destroy the American position in Vietnam. And in many cases, that's just not true. I found in the Pentagon Papers, and also says, that Diem's regime, quote, "compared favorably with other Asian governments of the same period in its respect for the person and property of citizens." Of course, it was authoritarian. It couldn't be anything else. It was a massive war, and an ideological one. And it certainly was far superior to what Ho Chi Minh and his comrades were offering. Christian Science Monitor, the reporter Dan Sutherland, 1970. Here's what he said. Under its new press law, South Vietnam now has one of the freest presses in Southeast Asia. And the daily paper with the biggest circulation here happens to be sharply critical of President Thieu. Since the new press law was promulgated 9 months ago, the government has not been able to close down Tim Sang or any other newspaper among the more than 30 that's being published in Saigon. And what he means there is that the communists took over the media, or at least the leftists in general. The left is far superior to the right in terms of propaganda. Newspapers are weapons of war. They're propaganda factories. The ruling class in the West lied about conditions in the North. Everyone who was, you know, in power in the U.S., it was clear that any withdrawal of American support for South Vietnam possibly lead to a Stalinist victory. But those who at one point led the fight against the South pretended not to know this. But there's no excuse for not knowing it. French journalist Jean Le Couture, the New Left really based a lot of their stuff on Vietnam from his works. Very supportive of the NLF. And he was invited to visit liberated South Vietnam after the war. And even though he was given a guided tour, upon his return, he expressed his, quote, shame, having contributed to the installation of one of the most oppressive regimes history has ever known. Later on, that same man said that during the war, my behavior was more of a militant than a journalist. I believed I was not opportune to expose the Stalinist nature of the Vietnamese regime in 1972, right at the time when Nixon was bombing Hanoi. Now, we know that leftists don't take responsibility for themselves. They don't take responsibility for anything. It's very hard to get them to be, it's like the Fonz trying to say he was wrong. So these are kind of half-hearted apologies, but they're huge. Now, Noam Chomsky, being a Jew as well, will never take responsibility. Yes, he did support the Khmer Rouge. He did support the North Vietnamese. He was well aware of Mao's influence in North Vietnam when he started writing. There were eyewitness accounts of Vietnamese defectors and well-documented scholarship at the time showing that the so-called land reform was a deliberate and brutal act of mass murder. His sole source was a British hack journalist, Richard Gott, who was revealed to have been on the payroll of the KGB later on, who was not a witness to events, who had traveled there more than a decade after the war as a guest of the Hanoi government. Oh yeah, he had to admit that there were massacres in the so-called land reform, but it didn't come from Hanoi. It was just the chaos of the war. But, you know, they're good. It's all good for the North Vietnamese people. The mass killings, Chomsky stated, laid the basis for a new society. It says, overcome starvation and rural misery and offers the peasants hope for the future. In other words, not only... I mean, he accepted to some extent the massacres that the North Vietnamese were engaged in, but then said they were good in general. Chomsky is such a fake. He's such a pseudo-intellectual. He actually argued that the lack of freedom, even the most basic natural law freedoms, were the result of the American war. And once the war is over and the communists take over, it'll all go away. He even said that once the war is done, once imperialist intervention is finished, he said the Vietnamese would develop a modern industrial society with much popular participation in its implementation and much direct democracy at the lower levels of organization. It would be a highly egalitarian society with excellent conditions of welfare and technical education, but with a degree of centralization of control in the long run will pose serious problems that can be overcome only if they eliminate party direction in favor of direct popular control at all levels. This is a kind of gushing over the communists. This is how ridiculous. This is what special pleading does to you. He had zero evidence that any of this would happen. Yeah, they dealt with it with a flexible and intelligent fashion, all right, by bringing in tanks and soldiers to ensure the slaughter of the reactionaries. No, they engaged in a policy of vengeful repression. Once the war was lost, They arrested and incarcerated hundreds of thousands of military officers, civil servants, intellectuals, religious leaders. The re-education camps, there were victims of liberation. They were confined to prisons and forced labor camps. Thousands were confined for years to suffer a slow death through overwork, malnutrition, disease. Again, today, to support all of this is fully accepted and grounds for promotion. What Hanoi did stacks up very close to what Pol Pot did. Had about the 2 million Vietnamese were deported to the new economic zones. That was located in more remote, inhospitable regions of the country. The idea that we could, you know, they could make it come to life. Well, they didn't. There were atrocities. Then, in 1978, there was a purge of these ethnic Chinese citizens. Deported those who possessed no gold or jewelry that could bribe them. And there was a huge exit bribe, possible to go back to China. And this is around the time that Joan Baez, the singer, did have problems with North Vietnam, but of course, Chomsky had no problem. You know, it's often said that the Vietnam War was a televised one, or the first televised one. That's misleading. It's not just randomly televised. What that really means is that the media filtered what the public saw. Because the media was pro-Hanoi, suddenly they were very concerned with showing the horrors of combat. And that's the worst part of this. Anyone who knew that, including people who supported the Marxists, that a communist victory would lead to a bloodbath, the ruling class dismissed it, and in fact even welcomed it. Well, the and the left, they just wanted peace, independence, and freedom, right? Well, they said so, that it must be true. You have Senator Mike Mansfield, Democrat from Montana, in a debate in March 1975, he said, well, I've spoken by telephone with Prince Sihanouk of Cambodia, and he was assured that if the U.S. withdrew its support for the anti-communists, he said not more than 4 or 5 Cambodians would be killed. He said the same thing about Vietnam. The judgment of Congressman Pete McCloskey, Republican from California. He visited Cambodia, came back and warned his colleagues that a bloodbath was certain to follow. Nevertheless, he still voted to terminate further assistance to the non-communist regime in Phnom Penh. And the same thing was said about Vietnam. In fact, the two were almost indistinguishable, which how they operated. The left, their political warfare campaign, their psyops were excellent. You know, the idea of the communist military strategy, if they could just tie down the Americans and ARVN, the so-called progressive forces of the world, and the U.S. would force Congress to cut off aid. There are many, of course, factors concerning the loss, especially when you had such a massive force against North Vietnam. Remember, in the early 70s, the northern economy collapsed entirely. The biggest restriction placed on the Western war plan was the sanctuaries. The West fought an enemy for 6 years that was fully resupplied and reinforced from hidden safe havens on the other side of the Cambodian border, and sometimes the Laotian border. The NVA established bases and roads inside so-called neutral Cambodia and Laos. They had huge supply bases there. It took a long time for anyone to really realize that that was an important part of the loss. This would never have happened if it were World War II, as the U.S. just burnt every city in Japan, slaughtered civilians by the millions. North Vietnam could easily supply its army through these different sanctuaries and road networks. The Ho Chi Minh Trail was one. And it was not, they had impunity from intervention. Unlimited supplies from China, USSR, Czechoslovakia, Cuba, North Korea, East Germany, and the U.S. through its ports, including the Haiphong Harbor. And it's not just a place to hide. They provided training. They supplied reinforcements. They had hospitals, all built by others. A lot of it American. Fuel depots. Now, every once in a while, you'd have Thai and Cambodian mercenaries going after them. You had a secret war in Laos against them. 1970, there was a 60-day incursion to Cambodia by the ARVN, the Army of South Vietnam, Republic of Vietnam. And it was massively successful. They captured a huge amount of supplies. Changed the course of the war for a short time. It was the only official operation by anti-communist ground forces to attack the communist sanctuaries during the course of the war. That was it. It would have been over. Barry Goldwater kept asking, why aren't the petroleum tanks and storage centers destroyed in North Vietnam? Of course, the war could have easily been won. Destruction of the Ho Chi Minh Trail, Laos and Cambodia, the elimination of NVA base camp sanctuaries in the same places, naval blockade of military supplies coming to North Vietnam and Cambodia's port of Sihanouk, and continued bombing of military targets, real targets inside of North Vietnam. The U.S. Linebacker 2 bombing campaign of North Vietnam, the eventual final bombing of naval mining of the Haiphong Harbor, quickly forced the NVA to the peace agreement table. But because the sanctuaries weren't touched, the communists quickly reverted to its old tactics. The USA withdrew, a few prisoners were freed, and nothing changed. I want to talk about repression. There is no comparison. South Vietnam was a free society, or as free as a society could be under conditions of total war. And it was far more representative in its government. The regime would love you to believe that the war was unpopular with the U.S. That wasn't true. It wasn't until maybe 1972, 73, that the American, more than 50% of the Americans turned against it. South Vietnam couldn't survive on its own, but neither could North Vietnam. They both were highly dependent on aid from elsewhere. Anything you could say about the South, you could say about the North. In a twisted way, Nixon faced no opposition to his abandonment of South Vietnam in 1972. Gerald Ford had no meaningful support for any kind of re-engagement, even in 75, even when it was almost all over. They were told by the press that North Vietnam, they just wanted peace and love. The U.S. could very easily simply maintain a long-term defense associated with South Vietnam. Arms, air power, occasionally special forces. The ARVN was more than competent if it was properly supplied and led. There was nothing wrong with South Vietnam as a nation. However, as the years went by, it was very dependent on American weapons. It didn't have its own weapons factories, but of course neither did Hanoi. If you go to my Patreon page, you will find a book, a short book that I published only there, in part concerning the so-called My Lai Massacre. Now, in places like Life magazine, you would have the most lurid pictures of dead GIs everywhere, deceptively captioned to promote Hanoi's agenda. Remember, during World War II, all pictures of American casualties were banned until Iwo Jima, 1945. So the question is, so how half of the U.S. military, 50% of the U.S. military defeated the highly advanced Japanese Empire a generation earlier, but a huge multinational commitment failed to defeat a third world military force over more than a decade. And that has not been answered properly. Yes, by 1967 even, the North Vietnamese economy had collapsed. But that doesn't mean that supplies from China and Moscow stopped. So it begs the question, how could over a million well-trained first world soldiers and a massive air campaign fail to dislodge the barely functional Marxist regime in Hanoi? One reason, of course, as I already mentioned, was the Press Law of 1970. Once the press was freed, the left took it over. They condemned Few all over the place. All of it was projection. Keep in mind that it was Erevien that fought to the last man in 1975. Never believe the crap that they were cowards or anything else. They fought right up until the last minute. They took the brunt of the casualties. They fought the bloodiest of the battles. The bloodiest battles of the war occurred after the U.S. withdrew, in fact. The Tet Offensive was turned back by the ARVN for the most part. Yes, they had Western air support. But it was the South Vietnamese Army that destroyed the offensive. Not that you were going to say anything about that in the West. Yes, the South Vietnamese Army did most of the fighting and took most of the casualties. Let me give you the worst example, or the best example. Battle for Quang Tri. John Carroll wrote an excellent article on this, although I'm positive he has autism. And I know this because he has an obsession with naming every group, every regiment, every platoon by number. So you know he's got to have. And there's another thing I mentioned before, the YouTube channel, Memory of South Vietnam, who's also run by an autist, but a very, very intelligent and a man who's doing the right thing. If you go to Memory of South Vietnam, it will change your opinion about the ARVN. Quang Tri was the bloodiest battle of the war in 1972. The U.S. had no ground troops involved. Some air power. But that's it. By this time, the NVA was using conventional forces. It wasn't using guerrilla forces anymore. This was the attack on Hue. The first of three assaults in different regions. April 3rd, they attacked in Central Highlands. Even on Lok, 60 miles from the capital. They had their best troops, the most battle-hardened troops. 30,000, 40,000 men. They had 200 tanks, air defense batteries. And they struck the Vietnamese Marine Corps and the Arvin 3rd Division. Now, the head of the 1st Corps was named General Hoang Lam. This is one of the people who shouldn't have been where he was. He rejected all intelligence reports that the enemy had massed large formations across the DMZ. When the NVA attacked, he was caught completely flat-footed. April 2nd, you had mass surrender. You had officers not making any attempt to destroy ammunition stocks or disable artillery pieces. The only thing that stopped the total slaughter was American airstrikes. The 1st Corps commander, Lam's, he had a flurry of conflicting and uncoordinated orders, and Dong Ha fell. Quang Tri City was abandoned, and that was a massive loss. The only group that maintained discipline was the Marine Corps. Now, the early communist successes gave an unfortunate sense of esteem and esprit de corps. Plus the fact that they believed that the political climate in the U.S. in 1972 would prevent any real kind of retaliation. So this was up to the ARVN. 1972, there were, 70,000 troops in Vietnam from the U.S. Nixon ruled out any more ground troops, but he was interested in air power. He did re-engage in that regard. But General Lam had to go. He was replaced by one of the best, Lieutenant General Ngo Quang Trung. He was a commander of the Mekong Delta Forces, considered the country's best commander. He showed up at the 1st Corps in less than 24 hours. He fired everybody. He restored order. He improved defenses. This was the best of the ARVN. He had appealed to few for additional troops. The 2nd Airborne Brigade arrived. 3rd Airborne Brigade arrived. The airborne units were very important here. Most of the airborne, in fact, were under Truong's command. Slowly but surely, the 1st Division of the ARVN retook some of the old American bases that had been overrun. South Vietnamese troops did tremendous damage to the NVA, along with American airstrikes, of course. They pushed the enemy back across the DMZ. Few directed Truong to recapture Quang Tri City, the only provincial capital at the time in enemy hands. Now, the town had no real strategic value, but Truong wanted to bypass it, destroy NVA units, and retake lost terrain. Once the counterattack occurred, the North Vietnamese were taken by surprise. You even had U.S. naval gunfire. Now, the NVA realized that Thieu would do whatever it took to recover the provincial capital. It was a bloody fight. In fact, General Quang, who was the NVA commander, created somewhat of a fortified the city to make it very difficult to take back. The Soviet made field guns and everything else, maximum fire support. In fact, it was their artillery and mortars that inflicted the bulk of South Vietnamese casualties. Now, some of these units from the ARVN were under strength, but eventually, Thieu sent more men. The outskirts of the city, ARVN was fighting hand-to-hand, house-to-house with the NVA. The 1st Marine Division of the of South Vietnam launched an assault at the same time, just north of the city. They stopped traffic on Route 560, which was the Communist Defenders' main supply line. You did have U.S. Marine Corps helicopters and Cobra tank helicopters and things like that. There were several attempts to retake the city, but it was fortified now. Truong didn't like the idea that people were saying it's only because of American air power that he's successful. So he said, you know, as far as the city is concerned, no more airstrikes. He drew kind of a circle around it. So the ARVN went on the offensive again. They came very close to overrunning it. Again, more hand-to-hand combat. North Vietnamese withdrew around the area. Casualties mounted, though, in the ARVN paratroopers. Now, there were other ways, once 560 was blocked, there were other ways of getting supplies, but it was much more difficult. They even brought in the 81st Airborne Ranger Battalion from the ARVN. The only bombing of the city that was permitted was the 2,000 laser-guided It was 2,000-pound laser-guided bomb on this fortress's northeast rampart. That's how the 1st, 5th Battalion was able to move into the fortress. However, the 2nd Airborne Brigade was annihilated eventually. There were huge casualties from the south, but massive casualties from the north. Another counterattack, August 3rd, also bogged down. He had to lift restrictions on American airstrikes again. He didn't like it. Again, you had hand-to-hand fighting, you had house-to-house fighting. Massive artillery barrages from the city caused a lot of South Vietnamese losses. Truong's pleas for more men was answered. The 1st Ranger Group showed up. He had a substantial number of battalions now. But here's the only thing the U.S. really kind of did that mattered. The U.S. faked an amphibious landing. 9th Marine Amphibious Brigade, they did everything, they went through all the motions. The radio traffic, the landing beaches, the embarking 400 ARVN Rangers, all this stuff. Naval gunfire. So when the bombing stopped, the North Vietnamese troops moved out of their bunkers, to confront the landing forces. Then they were caught in a massive barrage of naval gunfire. This is the kind of thing that could very easily have won the war. It didn't take long for the city to be retaken. Now, the event was big news worldwide. The ARVN, with some American support, had driven the North Vietnamese back across the border, proving that they are very competent, that they are fighting not just competent soldiers, but strategists, that they're willing to fight to the death, as they did in 1975. The communists wanted to say it was just because of the American U.S. bombing, but the South could have simply said, well, you only had the equipment you had because of the Soviet Union. And the Paris Peace Accords happened, which allowed 100,000 NVA troops to remain within South Vietnam's borders. What kind of, Thieu says in one of his interviews later on, he says, what peace treaty allows 100,000 enemies to remain in your country? Just like we've seen more recently, this truce just gave the North Vietnamese time to reconstitute their army. Military aid to South Vietnam was being slashed. The make-believe Watergate scandal was concocted, so he resigned. And because of that, that's when North Vietnam resumed its military campaign. They knew that there was going to be no American intervention. Remember, the draft was eliminated in 1973. But this proves the bravery and competence of the ARVN. Only the incompetence of one important general, I Corps, or the First Corps, forced the South into retreat. But once he was removed, the NVA lost. And there's many other examples. Rather than that, I went into detail there. I think it's interesting. And to think that the Army of the Republic of Vietnam was cowardly, or they surrendered at the first note. There's a lot of these myths floating around. They're lies. Even after the Americans long disengaged, they fought to the last man. The evidence for that is overwhelming. If you go to, there's many sources. I've already cited them for you. But why was it important to engage in Vietnam? Well, in Professor Rummel's Death by Government, Genocide and Mass Murder Since 1900, which came out in 1997, Communist Vietnam directly killed about 1.7 million people from 1945 to 1987, not counting war casualties. About a million were killed after 1975. Same thing goes for the Cambodian takeover. April 17th, 1975, 50 years ago, a little bit more. They imitated Mao and the Vietnamese. Now, eventually, Pol Pot hated the Vietnamese vehemently, which led to the Vietnamese invasion. But initially, he was as much pro-Soviet as he was pro-Mao. UNICEF estimated maybe 3 million were killed. UCA sociologist Patrick Huvelin, who has been there, says about 1.17 to 3.42 million Cambodians were killed. In his The Demographic Analysis of Mortality Crises, the Case of Cambodia, 1970-1979, which is National Library of Medicine in 2001. The Documentation Center of Cambodia, Craig Etcherson. The death toll there between 2 and 3 million, maybe 2.2 million, the most likely. After the Killing Fields, Lessons from the Cambodian Genocide, which was published by Bloomsbury in 2005. And he's visited grave sites. I mean, this isn't like the Holocaust. You actually have graves and people. Now, the Khmer Rouge does admit a lot of this, but just because they blame it on the Vietnamese. The UN and the Red Cross together said another 2.5 million Cambodians faced death and starvation due to the near destruction of Cambodian society because of the ouster of Pol Pot. Only American aid saved them. You have people so stupid, they honestly will tell you that the U.S. backed the Khmer Rouge. I don't know where they're getting this from. The closest I could come is that the bombing permitted the communists to use that as a propaganda tool to take over. But of course, the U.S. supported General Lannoy, who was a very good man. He was a very good general. And unfortunately, he had a stroke and was incapacitated. And again, that was very hard to replace him. You couldn't trust the monarchy, unfortunately, under Sihanouk. South Vietnam, it was far worse. Hundreds of thousands, right after 1975. 155,000 refugees fleeing the final NVA spring offensive were killed or abducted on the road to Thoai Hoa in 1975. 165,000 South Vietnamese died in the re-education camps. About 2.5 million were sent. There are so many works on this now. Slave labor in the so-called new economic zones. Another 50,000 deaths out of a total of 1 million deported. 400,000 boat people of 2.5 million who fled. Tens of thousands of suicides, by the way, in South Vietnam after the North Vietnamese takeover. Same thing goes for the Pathet Lao, overthrowing the royalist government in Laos in 1975. That's what was at stake here. Had North Vietnam been defeated, you would have another 10 million people living. And it wouldn't have been that difficult. If half the U.S. military can defeat the Japanese, who had aircraft carriers and probably the best planes of the war, then, you know, building up a very strong ARVN who was willing to fight to the death, sometimes with no ammunition, by the way, because near the end they had nothing. They were fighting with their hands. And, of course, the media. Battle death from the U.S., I guess the official number is 46,226. 153,000 wounded, 5,500 missing, and 10,000 non-battle-related deaths. 3.3 million troops fought over the course of the war on the southern side. North Vietnamese claim to have lost 1 million men. North Vietnamese somehow still won. Was peace brought to Indochina? No. More border clashes in 1978. Vietnam invaded Cambodia. They installed a puppet government there. More deaths and more murders. The Vietnamese refused foreign aid for the starving. Huge, massive number of Cambodians fleeing to Thailand. Massive famine. You know, the Khmer Rouge controls parts of Cambodia almost even to today. More death even there in these places. The Samarin regime, maybe 230,000, but that's speculation. Civil wars all over the place. That's what happened because of the American defeat. Peace wasn't brought there. There was some sense to interventionism against the communists. Given the very mentality of Marx and Lenin, this was a globalized revolutionary force that wouldn't stop. Yes, it had tons of support. The U.S. was building up them up as much as they were fighting them. But any empire that was, you know, that had taken China, it was getting way too large for anyone's comfort. Ideology wasn't the problem. Trade never stopped. Harriman is proof of that. Trade just continued, which is one of the most bizarre things. Your enemy is always getting the best and brightest of American technologies and scientists. Soviets were always being trained at American universities. No way that was going to happen during World War II, though. Or even today. And media lies, as always. Without the internet, that stuff was taken as true. Walter Cronkite. The media always has blood on their hands. They're incompetent. They had no right to say what they were saying. They had no real knowledge. They were making things up. And you have people like Noam Chomsky, who is still, you know, public intellectual number one. Everyone, you know, you're supposed to say, he's the dissident, right? multimillionaire. But he's a dissident. That's how American dissidents are, how wealthy they become, which makes no sense. But he's feted in every major Rockefeller foundation in the world. Every major NGO in the world loves him and invites him in and supported all of this stuff. To be a Maoist, to be a Stalinist or Leninist, that's all considered fully acceptable. To be a Pol Pot supporter may be a little weird, but you're not going to get in trouble for that. Only if you support, you know, Hitler or Franco. Totally different story. Then your life is destroyed. The story about South Vietnam is a lie. The story about the Vietnam War is a lie. Of course, it could have easily been won. It could have been won in a million different ways, but the regime didn't want it to be. The murder of Diem was the most obvious example, but it could have been won after that. Once it was stabilized under Thieu, you had millions of first-rate soldiers there willing to fight. You know, the South Korean delegation was pulled back because the Americans wouldn't let them fight. They were too good. If you go to my book on the subject, I spoke to the general in charge of the Korean detachment in the Vietnam War. I spoke to his granddaughter on Facebook a long time ago. And she sent me a few things that he had written in English. She's a liberal, by the way, a weirdo, but very conservative when it comes to the war. And that's exactly what he said. I can't think of his name off the top of my head, but he said, you know, we were wiping the floor with the communists. That's exactly why the West, the Americans, didn't want us to do anything. The Thais were there in huge numbers doing the same thing. They were winning constantly. The North Vietnamese were terrified of the Koreans. Therefore, they had to go. The U.S. had no desire to win the war, just like they have no desire to win the war on drugs. So 50 years on, everything's changed. China isn't Maoist anymore. Everything's changed there. Intervention is not the same as it used to be. So you could be vehemently opposed to American intervention abroad like I am now, but be equally vehemently in support of it during the Cold War. Those two different worlds, two different systems, they don't have much in common. Thank you again, everyone, for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.